Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Open a flask. Take your trousers off in the front seat and relax with Jules and Jim and their joyride. Our guest today is often found skulking around the ladies' underwear department wearing his omnipresent Mickey Mouse gas mask, tormenting the sale girls with his fiddling stick, and sticking his head around the changing rooms, shouting, "Your girdle's on fire." He is, of course, the top actor, Mark Benton.
Oh, Mark, that's me. Here.
Yeah? Thanks for having me.
How about that for an introduction?
Had you prepared that one for Mark, or could it have been for just that whoever it might have been?
That was a kind of, it was a general purpose introduction.
Well, I liked it, I loved
it. It kind of fits.
I thought it was apt.
Because I've known you for we've known each other for a long, long time.
A long, long time.
And it always seems to me that you're always driving everywhere. You don't get the train or the bus. You just drive everywhere.
Well, obviously, I'm driving everywhere at the moment. But yeah, I like my car.
I know you do.
I like to have a drive around, It's your little haven, isn't it? Play music. It's the only place I can get away with playing heavy metal without anybody shouting at me.
Oh, interesting. You're a heavy metalist in the car?
Yeah, well, I was a headbanger when I was young, and I was into, noise, and I still have a penchant for a bit of noise as well, yeah.
And do you find that, for instance, what's one of the most, what's the most exciting piece of heavy metal you listen to in the car?
Well, it always changes, doesn't it? I mean, I used to love Ministry, and I remember when I discovered Ministry, and it was kind of industrial, was something I'd never heard of, and I loved it. I used to play it full blast in the car, and I tended to drive a little bit faster, which isn't always a good thing.
Exactly, that's what I wondered. If you hear certain exciting music, does it make you drive that little bit more aggressively, a little bit more
I think it.
On
I
the
think
edge?
It did, yeah. I mean, I think it did. I mean, obviously, I'm an old codger now, so I've calmed down, but I just used to love it. I mean, I think, I remember when I was young, there was a guy called Mad Mick, and we sold him some, we got some herbal cigarettes and took the insides out of herbal cigarettes and some flour, and we told him it was drugs. And
Mad Mick fell for it.
We got a tenner off him, I think, for it. but I wasn't there, and I remember he took a little bit of flour. I think he must have ate a little bit of flour or something, and he started talking about green men and all this kind of stuff.
Well, he hadn't. So, in other words, he had nothing to change his senses or perceptions whatsoever.
No, it was literally
because,
flour.
Because you told him that's what it was, and he paid for it, it became that.
He was going to get the most out of it. But I remember him saying, all the lads were going, oh, all he kept saying was, oh, Ben, he's just a poser, isn't he? He's a poser. Because at the time I think I'd gone into level 42 or something, and I was out of the gang then. So Mad Mick hated me.
So heavy metal, now just think about this, like metal and Ministry and stuff, and industrial metal and stuff like that. Because you grew up in Dormanstown?
No, Grangetown.
Grangetown.
Yeah. That,
which is in Middlesbrough.
No, Middlesbrough. Oh.
But that's very industrial, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I lived right between ICI and British Steel, basically. We were the last little town. I mean, it was sort of the roughest council estate in Cleveland where I grew up,
But they've got those. I remember walking along the beach there, and you can see through huge doors, like massive plumes of fire.
Yeah.
Where the melting things.
You mean like whether subconsciously that affected my.
Well, they say that, don't they? Say, Black Sabbath and people like that who've grown up in Birmingham and hearing the banging of industry, suggested heavy metal. So was it the same with you?
I don't know, it might have been. I mean, who knows, subconsciously. I mean, it was like that when I grew up. I mean, literally, we were in the works and, one side you'd see this, you'd see the fires going off at ICI, and the other side you'd get the steel rolling through the mills, and the blast furnaces were there as well, because my granddad worked on the blast furnaces. And yeah, maybe, I don't know.
I love a bit of that.
Did you? A bit of industry.
Yeah.
I love a bit of industry. If I could paint, well, figuratively, I think I'd go around and paint a bit of industry.
Yeah.
It's quite difficult to paint a hot ingot. Because when I was at art school, we used to go around to the Bell Foundry in Whitechapel, and it's really hard to paint fire that looks like fire.
But, Mark, when you were there, surrounded by these great furnaces and industrial things, yeah, do you expect that you were going to go and work there?
Well, of course, when I grew, I mean, by the time I'd got to working age, there was no jobs. I mean, there was the unemployment was like, there was nothing going on at all.
So you thought, I'll go to RADA instead?
I'll become an actor instead. Well, actually, the thing was, my uncle was an actor. And when he was an actor, it was sort of unheard of from my, where I'm from, Middlesbrough, you know, around that area, unheard of for people to go and become actors. And he headed off. And I remember, I mean, I must have been sort of 8, 9, and he used to come back during the summer holidays, and he used to bring people back with him. His best friend at drama school was Michael Beck, and I'd look up to them and I'd be like, oh my God, I really want to be like you. I went to see my uncle in a place called Colne, and you know, this bizarre play, people with masks on and stuff, but I just remember thinking, oh, I want to do this.
What was your uncle's name?
Yeah, it was, well, his real name was Johnny Benton, but his acting name was Michael Gunn. But he was a bit of a hero man, really, and he was a great man, and I wanted to be like him, and then it just stuck, and then I was in a band, and I was acting, and it was always, oh, which one am I going to try and become an actor, or try and make it with a band?
Did you go around, did you do any gigs?
We did, and we started off as a heavy metal band called Stallion, with a Y, which I'm very proud of.
Where was the Y?
I came up with
the name. Where was the Y?
Stallion.
Nice, yeah. Stallion.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Nice. And who were you in Stallion?
I was the guitarist.
Yeah.
But I mean, I use that term loosely. And then we split up and we formed this kind of pop funk band. We used to rehearse in the music room at school, and we didn't have a name, and we were going to do this gig at school. Well, I say gig, it was like a, you know, play 3 songs in the second half of a kind of mishmash of things from the school. And there was a poster on the wall for makeup, and it said Face Moods on it. So we just went, oh, let's call ourselves Face Moods. But sadly, our wonderful, he was a brilliant bassist. He's a very talented lad, but he had unfortunately tried to hold up a corner shop with a plastic gun. And he got put on a curfew. So we were just, that was it. The band was over. Musical differences.
But interesting, when people want to be in bands at that age, like everybody wants to be the guitar player or the drummer, yeah, or the lead singer. Nobody wants to be the roadie or the accountant,
yeah,
or the and all of that. Yeah.
That's a good one, to want to be there, an accountant.
Yes,
I was in a band in the 70s, and we played at a place in Stockton, and the woman who ran the place said, "If you don't do any Elvis, they're going to kick off." And we said, "Well, we don't do that. We don't know any. We won't be doing that." She said, "You better," and we didn't. She stopped us after 3 songs. So, are you going to do any Elvis? Because they're all getting itchy out there. And we said, no, we're not doing it. And then it did actually all kick off. There was people started fighting each other with pool cues. Have you ever had anyone having a fight in front of you on stage?
Oh, well, frequently, yes. I mean, that was a good part of the learning curve. But I mean, I think that was the thing. The places used to be much rougher. I think they used to get fights in places like more often, didn't you? In pubs and things like that. And you just sort of ignore it, you know, sort of carry on playing, try and calm them down.
Did you ever feel in danger for your life?
No, although I did once. We played in one time. We were on tour with the Tubes, and we were opening for them. This group, the Tubes, who were kind of great. But in this one particular town, the local sort of band who was sort of happening at the time, they opened for them. But it was agreed we could go on in the middle. But we weren't on the bill. So the curtain comes down after the first local band's been on. Then the curtain comes up, and all the audience, and it's a big theatre, are expecting the Tubes, but instead it's us. So the hooray turns to as it may realise it's us, they've got us for half an hour now. And it just went from bad to worse. And in the end, they just hated us. And they were booing, and then they were chucking things at us. And the security man came onto the side of the stage and said to me, "You've got to tell them to get off. We can't guarantee your safety any longer." And in the end, it was like sort of a load of missiles coming onto the stage. And Glenn Tilbrook did a thing that was brilliant in that he said, He said, do you really hate us? If you really hate us, want us to take off? Yeah, stand up, put your hands above your head and applaud and cheer as loud as you can. We'll go, and so they also, so we went off to a standing ovation. Unbelievably.
Brilliant.
Did you drive around to your gigs?
At the time, I didn't have a car, no.
What was your first car?
My first car cost £250 on the road. And it was, I still wish I had one now. It was a Saab, but it was the old shape. It was the round shape.
Oh, nice. Very nice shape, yeah.
And it was the estate version. And it had fins at the back.
Did that have a particular name?
I don't remember it. I just remember it being I think it was a 95 or a... Because there was a later version that was called 95 as well, but this was a 95 or a 94.
Yeah.
And my dad bought it for me. And it cost £50 for the car. It cost £50 to tax it. And it cost £150 for the insurance. And I used to sit in the drive and, like, you know, act like I was driving it. And he got it going and it wouldn't go. I mean, I loved that car. Bright orange it was. And everyone used to take the mickey in. It didn't have a boot handle. You had to put it in to open the boot. And it wouldn't go above 60. But it was great. And I used to think it was really cool because it had this thing called freewheel hub, which was like, if you put this freewheel hub on, it's basically like going in neutral down a hill. So every time you went down a hill and took your foot off, it would sort of just glide down the hill. Yeah, I loved it, that car. And I left to go to RADA, actually. The Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
But could you have not taken the Saab to the Royal Dramatic Academy?
No, I was too scared to drive it in London. And I didn't even know if it would make it to London, you know. But I remember
Of journeys had you been going on it then? Just local?
Just local, yeah.
How far would you go?
I'd go to York or Newcastle.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when I was probably about 9, I used to think, when I grow up, I'm going to get a Jensen Interceptor. That was the car, that was my dream car.
Yeah.
And then looking back, and I think, I wouldn't be seeing dead in one of them now. I used to think they were really good looking, but they're quite weird, ugly things, I think, now.
Well, I remember my dad, the cars I remember my dad had, he had a Westminster.
Oh, I had one of those recently,
which
lovely.
Was a big, you know, lovely. Beautiful. And my biggest memory of the Westminster was, I remember we left my auntie's once and, of course, there were no seatbelts then, and I just was messing around. I must have been 5, maybe, or... I literally rolled out of the back door, or down the road. I opened the back door and just rolled out.
We were talking to Imelda May, and the same thing happened with her when her sister rolled out of the back door. Yes. So there's a trend appearing here.
Yes. But in the old days, it was perfectly acceptable if you were a bit too bored of a child to get them to just, you know, put them in the back of the car, take them for a journey, leave the back door slightly open in the hope that they might roll out.
Yeah. And so you rolled out down the road?
Yeah. Rolled for quite a while, apparently. Had a big scratch on my head.
Oh, dear, that sounds horrid.
What sort of speed were you doing?
Probably
70, 80.
120. Around the corner.
That's quite a thing, though, to fall out.
It's very painful. I did fall out of a car. We had a Bedford
You've
van.
You've done it as well.
We had a Bedford van with sliding doors, right? And which we bought for £15. Well, I managed to get it for squeeze. They didn't seem very pleased with it, but I was very pleased. Anyway, and somehow this roadie we had was driving it. I was in the... And he said, can you just check out the back, make sure that there's no mirror on the passenger side. I slid back the door as he's just gently going along, leant out the door, looked behind and shouted, yep, you're all clear, at which he turns right, propelling me out of the van to the left straight onto the road. I had to lay in the back of the van for quite a while. But it's the same sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I think the modern door doesn't allow that so easily.
No.
No, I'm the only one who hasn't flown out of a door yet.
But I remember it was like a tank. It was like, I mean, I know I was only small, but, you know, in your memory.
It was a big brute of a car. Was it black?
No, he painted it, I think. Or my mum painted it, hand-painted it, I believe.
What colour?
Blue and cream, I think it was.
Hand-painted blue and cream, Austin Westminster.
They might say to me, I'm wrong. My dad and my sister might say, you're wrong.
What did they paint it with? Emulsion? Dulux?
Probably.
Gloss. Dulux gloss.
Yeah.
I had an Austin A110 Westminster, and I loved it. The smell of it, I loved. I mean, it was just like being a sort of senior police officer. You needed a pair of gloves. And in all of the things you saw, the TV things like sort of Gideon's Way, whatever, these policemen would be piling into the Austin Westminster and sort of chasing after the villains. But in reality, I can't see how they ever caught anybody. I'm amazed anybody has ever apprehended with an Austin Westminster.
Yeah, it was massive.
Massive, very slow.
Well, he had that, then he had a Cambridge.
Oh, yes. Well, there's a smaller model variant, of course.
Cambridge Estate.
I had a Austin Cambridge. And me and my friend...
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We bought it for 50 quid and we drove to Aylesbury and there was Lindisfarne on it in concert there. So we went round the back and saw the roadies hanging around the back and said, we're friends of the group, so can we go in and wait for him in the dressing room? And they let us in. So we just then found a crate of Newcastle Brown Ale, just walked out with it.
Lindisfarne's own special.
And sat in our Austin Cambridge and drank it all and slept in it overnight.
Why did they come up with names like that, I wonder? Cambridge, Westminster.
Austin Somerset is the car that I buried in the field because it went wrong all the time. It was never right.
So was it like revenge?
It was kind of like, it's such a lovely thing. I want to keep it forever, so I'll bury it in a field. So it's there as a monument.
Oh, like the ant farm, you know those people? Have you heard of those? I don't know. The ant farm, they're an artist's in California. There's two things I know they do. One is they do a reenactment once a year of the assassination of poor Kennedy with the car and everything, because they've got all the cars. And the other thing they've done is in the desert, they got like sort of maybe 10 or 15 Cadillacs and buried them nose in the... it goes from 1950, 51, 50, or something like this. 1950, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, etc. Because as you go along, the fins get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Because they're all stuck out of the ground.
And they're all stuck at an angle behind one another with the noses buried in the ground, yeah.
Well, that was what I did with mine. It was sticking with its nose out of the ground. Hmm. And the fellow who I got to dig the hole, he was having his breakfast was 8 tins of lager.
Sounds like a reliable fellow.
And what did he think about the? I mean, what did you say to him?
He didn't ask any questions. It was actually for a documentary. They wanted me to do something,
right?
You know, to have a story around it. So I want to get rid of that car, but I want to keep it. So I'm going to bury it.
Oh, Jim, do something daft, will you?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. Yeah. When I had my Austin Cambridge, I used to like dressing the part. And I like that idea of dressing the part if you're going out in a particular vehicle.
I had a Rolls-Royce Silver Cloud. And so I always like to imagine myself on a Saturday morning in a sports jacket with a polo neck going to the golf club. So I put a polo neck in a sport. I mean, I never went to a golf club, but I imagined that's what somebody in Isha would do in this Rolls-Royce.
Yeah, and you could drive there and hang around and hope that you might make some friends.
Yeah, I'd have a gin and bitter lemon and have a cigarello.
Yeah, and just
it's
hang about.
It would be great, yeah.
I'm just rocking my brains to the fact, what would I wear to go in a bright orange Saab?
What, Swedish? Kind of
ABBA, sort of.
Naked.
I could have one of those.
Naked, of course.
Yeah, naked with one of those big orange bouncy. What do they call those big orange bouncy things you used to bounce on?
With the two little horns.
Not a whopper. What are they called?
Space hopper. Yeah. Molly, our producer, has reminded us that it is a space hopper. Now, there's a form of transport we haven't discussed. Did you have a space hopper?
I did. We did have a space hopper, actually, I think. But I think...
Did you share it?
We shared them. Of course. Among the household, you know.
With your mum and dad.
Yeah. I remember we used to have a car and we wrecked this car. It was an old car. and we used to have mud fights. Do you know Clarty Marty? We used to have Clarty Marty, which is basically mud and water, you know, and you make mud cakes and all that. Yeah. But we used to fight. We wrecked this car. My dad had got this car, put it on the drive to do up or something, and the whole street would come and play in this car. It was great.
He must have been heartbroken. Look what my children have done. They've took up the whole street to come and ruin.
Exactly. He's still not talking to me now. Bless him.
Talking about clothes, I put this jacket on today. This tweed jacket, which I haven't had on.
Can I just describe it to the listeners? Yeah. It's a delightful colour. So how would you? What colour would you describe that as, Mark?
Russet.
Russet. It's a russet. I'd call it a russet colour. Yeah. Tweed, thick, heavy tweed jacket.
Yeah. Nice.
Beautifully cut, like a 1930s well-dressed farmer.
And the fella who made the tailor, no, it was a fella in Harris. He said, you can always tell. He says, if you go into an old Oxfam and you see an old tweed jacket, he says, have a sniff of it. If it was made before, I think it was 1967, they used to cure the tweed with sheep piss. So he said, if it smells of sheep piss,
it's a good one.
You can age it. So
I thought you could say it smells of sheep piss. It's a really good one, and I happen to have one that smells of sheep piss. It costs a bit more than the others, but you should have it.
Yeah. Anyway, so I haven't worn that for about 10 years, and I always like what you can find in your pockets of a jacket that you haven't worn for a long time. And in my pockets was this, which why don't you describe what I found in my pocket?
Well, I would describe it's a miniature Cross and Blackwell cream of celery soup can is how I would describe it. What sort of how
made
would you
of
describe
tin.
It? Made of tin.
I don't know where I got it from or why it was in my pocket.
Yes, it's a tiny, tiny can of soup, celery soup. It's the size of your thumb, in great condition. Does it open?
I've not tried.
And it's quite it's.
Oh no! Was there something awesome? Do you see that? Like spores came out of it.
Yes.
And I breathed them in.
Yeah. Yes. You know, you could have breathed in an ancient disease from a Victorian
celery's disease from celery soup. No,
yes. Come out? Did you see?
Yes, I saw. Yes, like? Yeah. And I think it was probably from a 1950s doll's house. But okay. all of the dolls will be dead, so that's like a haunted doll's house that you've
and
got.
And that was the ghost of the dolls.
What I think it is, Jules, is I think he's got me under false pretenses. He wants to get rid of me, so he made me open the soup so that I'll expire.
And now, a message from our sponsors. I've got a problem.
Yes?
I'm always getting out of my car, not wearing any knickers, and the paparazzi have a field day.
Well, thank goodness you wear trousers. But what if you were a Scotsman?
That would be a problem.
Not anymore. Now you can save your dignity with this all-weather, leather and brass-fringed posing pouch. The press will never photograph you again.
How wonderful.
You've just been to Sicily, haven't you?
Yeah, I went to Sicily. I was in a film called Serrano, which is a musical version of Cyrano de Bergerac.
With Peter Dinklage.
With Peter Dinklage.
Did you go on a plane with him?
No, he was amazing. But with the COVID, it was quite a harrowing experience travelling on the plane because, you know, from the moment I walked out of the house, I had the mask on, basically. And I don't know about you guys, but after a while, it was so claustrophobic, and of course, so I get the car to the airport. I'm in the airport with a mask on. I'm on the plane. When you can't take it off. I mean, like normally, every day you go somewhere, you get sick of the mask. You say, I'm just going to step outside for 5 minutes and get a bit of air or something. But of course, you couldn't there. So I remember getting to Sicily, just like it's like a sort of slow motion, ripping this mask off. It's air. But yeah, I've flown quite a bit. I mean, I remember the first sort of big job I did. I did a world tour with a theatre company called Cheek by Jowl. We did As You Like It. I remember we went to Japan and we were doing it at the Globe. And
there's a Globe in Japan?
Yeah, the Globe's in Tokyo. Oh. But we did this. We were doing this play, and I remember Adrian Lester, amazing actor, and Patrick Toomey were on stage doing this scene. And me and another actor, Sam Graham, we would go on in this scene, and he wasn't there. Sam wasn't there, and then it came to our queue, and I stood there thinking, "What do I go on? What should I do?" And then all I can hear is that the assistant stage manager going, "You know, Sam Graham, you are off. Sam Graham, you are off." So I ran on stage, and then I made Shakespeare up. You know, I said something like, "You know, my mistress did bid me tell you what love is," and then went into this speech that I did later on in the scene. So I'm doing this speech that I went later on in the scene, and then about four lines in, Sam comes sliding on stage, like completely out of breath, shaking, like this. And I'm doing this speech, and then we sort of stop, look at him, and then he starts from the start of the scene again.
No.
When I've already, you know...
given the end away.
Oh, my God. So then we're going through the scene, and I'm thinking, well, what do I do now? Because I'm going to get to my bit. And I've already done it, so I can't remember what I said, but I made Shakespeare up again to get over that bit. The best thing was I looked out, and in Japan you have translators who were sitting sort of at the side in this little booth. I remember looking out when I was making it up, and I remember them seeing them, and they're going, like, flicking the pages, looking at each other, going, where's this bit? Oh, I tell you.
So they're translated for the audience.
Yeah, they translate for the audience, yeah.
So they'd have to repeat, so you just blame it on them.
Exactly, and funnily enough, at the time, they all had masks on. So the whole the whole theatre was, you know, they all had masks on.
Well, because they did anyway, pre-COVID masks.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something to do with, you know, actors spit or whatever. But yeah, so, and we toured with that job. I mean, I went everywhere, Brazil we went to, and we're on the Copacabana Beach. And... We'd gone out to this do, it was British Council do, and it was an all-male cast. So someone had said, oh, you know, where's the club? Where's the most exciting club? We want, you know, where are the girls and all this? And so we went, oh, well, it's here. This guy said, I'll go there. We were expecting this big glitzy club, and it was this horrible, you know, dive where you go in and there's, you know, just women walking around and some... big bloke in the corner playing with himself, and it was like I tell you what it was like, you know those in those 70s movies where the hero gets drugged without knowing, or he takes drugs, like, and the lights start flashing and the music goes all funky and it's really, you know, and I remember sitting there like sweating, thinking, oh God, I don't want to be here. And eventually we got out. It was one of those where, you know, it cost no money to get in, but it was like I had a Coke or something, and it cost like, it was $20 for this Coke, you know. It was like, just pay it, let's get out. And then we walked on the beach, and it was like, oh, there's nobody on the beach. This is, where's everybody? And then these two coppers, like, we walked right across the beach to us. There's about five of us, and they had the guns out, and they were like pointing the guns at us, what are you doing, what are you doing? And we're like, oh, we're English, we're actors, like this, on the beach,
we're Shakespearean.
No, Shakespeare like this.
What did he say? What was this?
Well, he said empty your pockets, just like a bit like you. What's in your pockets?
What would they have said if they'd have found that little peas or whatever it is you had?
But of course, I got my pockets out, and I had some money in my pocket. And I remember holding the money like that in one of my hands, thinking, "Oh my God, he's going to think I'm trying to bribe him." You know what I mean? Like panicking, because obviously, you know, this is like one of the first times I've been away from home.
And you don't want to say, "I'm not trying to bribe you."
Exactly. So I'm just panicking like this, and then at the time I smoked. And I remember he started sniffing our fingers because he thought we'd been smoking dope on the beach. That was his thing, yeah. I think.
Not putting your fingers somewhere in...
So he goes, like, weird, going, like, let me smell your fingers. I'm like, oh, okay. So he's going on, people smelling the fingers, and he comes to me, and he smells my fingers, and then he sort of stops, and then he smells them again.
Ah, like the sniffer dog.
Yeah. Oh, my God, and I'm standing there thinking, oh, no, cigarettes, like this. And he, honestly, it felt like, I mean, it must have been seconds, but it's one of those situations where, you know, you're standing there thinking, and it felt like forever that he's sniffing my fingers. And then eventually he sort of went, okay. And then he walked us back to the hotel. And I tell you...
Still sniffing your fingers.
Well, I just... It was one of the... Being that, you know, a lad from the borough, it was an experience I'd never forget, because it was terrifying. And, you know, the whole sort of length of that night encapsulated... It was like horror. So, yeah, my experience...
And this is at the Copacabana.
That's where we went on the Copacabana Beach.
I can never say that. I always want to say Copacabana.
You don't think this terrifying thing with this policeman, with his... suspecting you of some drugs misdemeanours, do you don't think it was karma related to the years earlier when you tried to sell Mad Mick talcum powder and herbs from herbal tobaccos as drugs?
Yeah, it might be. He may have been related to Mad Mick, you never know.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to say thank you very much, Mark Benton. It's been wonderful hearing about the Shakespeare. I had no idea of the sort of excitements that Shakespearean actors got involved with.
Yeah,
it's rock and roll.
Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, it's having your fingers sniffed on a beach. I'd never imagined that.
I don't know. If somebody said to you, if, even if it was an official of the law, if they said to you, "Can I sniff your fingers?" Would you you'd have a sort of question mark over that, wouldn't you?
A massive question mark. But if he said, "Can I sniff your ass?" Yes. That'd be even worse. Thank you, Benno, for all your attention and stories.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, off you go.
Bye.
So there goes Mark Benton, the Shakespearean actor who's had his fingers sniffed.
He sold me this just before he left. It's this white powder and this stuff here. It was 100 quid, but he said it's really good.
Yeah.
Perhaps you'd like to try some and see if you can see some spacemen.
Well, that's self-raising, and that, on the other hand, is a packet of Trill budgie feed.
This podcast was produced and edited by Molly Stewart.
Sound engineers were James Stewart and George Latham.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.